Hello, and welcome to Cruising Through History. My name is Xander, sitting here with Scott Cruz. Scott, where are we cruising through today?
Well, Xander, I thought I'd do a little something different. Today we're going to talk about dragons.
Okay. Dragons, so you mean, like, historically there aren't dragons. But so right. What do you mean by talking about
dragons? Well, the mythology of dragons, how they entered our mythologies, how maybe the whole story of dragons sort of came about. I mean, there's several scholarly theories about that. And when you look at almost every culture, they sort of have dragon myths in them.
Yeah, so how did dragons, with cultures that are, you know, there's not internet when the times these things in culture are coming in that are called dragons. So mm-hmm. how do you make a universal
there's
thing?
A couple of theories. One is that one scholar has theorized that people have an innate fear of snakes. And a lot of the earlier depictions of dragons weren't what we think of dragons. You know, we think of Smaug from The Hobbit and with wings and blowing fire and flying and that. But a lot of depictions of early snake, or what they would have called dragons, were snake-like. They didn't have wings. They looked like big, giant, well, snakes. They were long. They had legs, but a lot of them didn't have wings. And that's one of the differences between, like, Eastern depictions of dragons and Western depictions of dragons. And so the other theory is that ancient cultures found fossils. And so because if you would find a fossil of a dinosaur, you couldn't really match it to anything. So they think maybe the stories came out of there. Now, the only problem with that theory is that Scandinavia has a rich history of stories of dragons and sea monsters and sea serpents in their mythology, and there's no real fossils in Scandinavia.
Mm-hmm.
So that could be the only thing that punctures it. So there's not a lot of agreement on why there seems to be, even going back to the ancient Mesopotamian cultures, and Egypt had that too. So even going back that far, we find that there's dragon, what we call dragons. A lot of time they look like serpents. And I guess this is where it gets a little confusing.
Yeah, because it sounds, I mean, this is, for once, we have once again selected a topic that I actually know things about. So it's like there's this mythos, like this mystery with what are dragons? Like, how did that happen? And, you know, these theories seem to be playing off of people's fears or people's something unknown is making what these theories come from. Though the Scandinavia one's interesting. I think one of those things with dragons are things like kind of like almost like Loch Ness-esque kind of ideas.
Yes.
Was like if you heard something in a mountain and it echoed across the entire mountain, and you know, if it's snowy or something, you'd think, oh my gosh, what's this monster making that sound? That could be.
Right.
Well, I don't know if there's another theory for that.
Right.
But that's what I think when I could possibly hear that. But go on. How did this, I guess, even more cultures, how did that proliferate? What happened because of
that? Well, even in different cultures, the dragons would mean something different.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times in Chinese culture, the dragon would actually be sort of a symbol of prosperity. And it was usually not antagonistic toward people.
Mm-hmm.
So they had a dragon called the Ying Long, which was actually winged. But during, and I just flapped my arms for some reason.
Scott the dragon.
Exactly. And so, but during, as we go along here, depictions, it loses its wings and it becomes a different kind of creature. And also, a lot of dragons were associated with water, whereas in the West, dragons are associated with fire.
Mm-hmm.
So that was interesting that there was this sort of difference where it wasn't seen. And we were, I was talking to Jason, who records for us before this, and you know, you see any sort of, you know, you go to a parade on Chinese New Year or something, and the dragon looks like a snake. It's very long, and you know, it's got a lot of people in it.
Yeah, you'll see they'll have multiple people kind of have it holding poles and kind of doing snake-like movements with this kind of costume or puppet, I'd almost say, is more like it.
Right, and
that's
yes.
from a lot of, I would say, seems like, was this Chinese culture that you were looking at?
Yes.
Japanese culture and, as well?
Well, the thing about China is it influenced the image of the dragon in all these other Asian countries, Japan,
mm-hmm.
Vietnam, and Korea. So they all have their dragon stories, too. It's in the West, though, where it really changes, where the dragon actually speaks. And that doesn't happen at the beginning. In Greek mythology, Heracles fights the Hydra, and the word they use for it is a word that you can translate as either serpent or dragon. And in Roman mythology, Virgil writes about a shepherd who fought a dragon, but he uses the word Draco and serpents. Again, they're interchangeable. You're using the same.
It's all related to snake, really.
Yes.
That's really what a...
See, that's where I think that theory is pretty good, because what I'm seeing is a lot of things that look... Or they're exaggerations of other reptiles that actually exist.
Mm-hmm. Like Komodo dragons.
Komodo dragons. It's right in the name.
Mm-hmm.
Iguanas, Gila monsters. And maybe people didn't really have a language to explain these things. And a lot of people think, especially in Asian cultures, the Chinese crocodile, it's a rather large creature.
Yep.
Was sort of gave birth to this myth of, because it looks just like, in fact, Marco Polo writes of this in one of his travels. There's a great book called The Penguin Book of Dragons. And I think of Pendragon, but I'll get to that later. And he's got an excerpt from Marco Polo's book, and he talks about traveling to the south of China, which would probably, the name he called it would be probably Yunnan Province, which is in southern China. And he talked about these creatures. And of course, as we know, in some of his stuff, he exaggerated things a bit. You know, eating lions and stuff like that. Well,
those exaggerations, like you say, eating lions, travel writing historically exaggerates. Like, that's
yes.
a very common thing in travel writing, to heavily exaggerate your tales because it's so different and you want
right.
to embellish everything, which would include something like, if you see, you know, an iguana, you don't want to just say, oh, there was this little lizard that was there. You're going to be like, this massive creature I've never seen before.
Right, and he told this tale when he was back in Italy,
mm-hmm.
you know, of course, when he was imprisoned and the other guy wrote it down. And so what they think he saw was a Chinese crocodile, which are, they're endangered. But the way he described it would describe a crocodile, you know, with the little legs,
yeah,
the big snout, the eyes. So that was, I thought that was very interesting. And but I think what happens when you get to about the 12th or 13th century in medieval Europe, it's sort of this coming together of all these stories. That's how I saw it. Because, of course, dragons become evil because in the Bible, dragons were evil.
Yeah, and, you know, that snake reference, you know, Adam and Eve being deceived by the serpent or the snake
yep.
could influence that idea of dragons being evil.
Right, and in fact, in the book of Isaiah, it talks about Leviathan, the sea monster,
mm-hmm.
and how it describes it as it can only be... Only the Lord can slay the dragon because it's so powerful. And that's another, you know, that's another thing. You see this in early Christian literature of saints slaying dragons. Of course, we have St. Patrick driving the snakes out of Ireland.
Yeah, and when we talk about dragons in literature, dragons appear in literature after this time period almost constantly. Like, it's such a literary canon to slay the dragon,
mm-hmm.
or to face the dragon, to rescue the person or princess from the dragon.
Mm-hmm.
The dragon reoccurs as almost this test for people.
Yeah.
And from what you're saying, what you found is really it comes from this proliferation of the evil dragon that can only be slain by the Lord or
yeah.
with godly power. So how is that? How have you seen that?
Yes, how it almost becomes, you know, a quest. And yes, it becomes kind of a cliche after a while. But it seems like even with, in Greek and Roman mythology, even then it seems like only sort of superior people can beat a dragon
mm-hmm.
or a serpent. even in the Bible, the Lord seems to be the only one that can slay Leviathan. And I kind of thought of that, and I thought, you know, that seems interesting that you're right. It becomes a story of in Beowulf. Now, Beowulf is interesting because it's the first piece of literature we have that where you have a dragon slayer.
Mm.
And then later stories spin out of like St. George and the dragon. But it had to be someone special. You know, you always think of Camelot and pulling the sword out of the stone.
Yeah, and Beowulf being the first. You know, Beowulf was, in the writing, extraordinary person. Like, better than any sort of other men, kind of beating demons, kind of beating all sorts of things. And then there's a dragon. And the thing is, the dragon is also the most difficult.
The dragon's the third challenge.
Yes.
And you're right, it is the most difficult.
I think he actually dies.
He does.
Killing the dragon.
Spoiler alert, yes.
I think we have a few thousand years, if you're sorry about that. So,
right.
So you had a few thousand years to read this one.
Exactly. Ironically, J.R.R. Tolkien, in 1926, he did a translation of Beowulf. And then, actually, it's been released now. It was released in like the last 10 years or so, with all his lectures on it, too. So there's all this commentary. But it's interesting because I thought, you know, he put all these dragons in his Hobbit story, which came later.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure he was influenced by that as well.
I mean, at some point, I know people with fantasy, everyone says, you know, everyone's a derivative of Tolkien, essentially, at this point. Right. It's almost like everything was a derivative of Beowulf, in a sense, because there's always that idea of the hero's journey and challenging the heroes through thick and thin.
Yes.
That's kind of Beowulf's three challenges was all about. Challenging a hero in multiple ways.
Right,
so,
yeah.
The dragon, classic challenge. And you see that be the climax of so many different stories because you think of The Hobbit, where the dragon at the end, what was it, Smog?
Smog.
Smog,
yes.
At the end. The end of the movies, at least, is the challenge, is the big bad of the whole thing.
Right. I'll never be able to read The Hobbit again without having Benedict Cumberbatch's voice in my head voicing the dragon, which is another thing where, you know, dragons almost become anthropomorphized. They're talking. There was the movie Dragonheart. Sean Connery was the voice of the dragon. And so when we see dragons now in movies, they talk. And they hoard gold. Mm-hmm. And they live in caves, even though they have wings. And so they have these sort of human qualities. They're greedy. They're gluttonous. They're all these things. So we attribute, but we also attribute negative human traits to them. We don't say, hey, look at it. They're optimistic. They're spreading joy. They're usually killing things.
And this particular interpretation of the dragon is a very, again, Western interpretation of the dragon.
Yes.
Because if we look into like Chinese or Japanese dragons or even a lot of Southeast Asian dragon myths, they're kind of neutral to good. There's a vast range of what a dragon,
right.
Is it a good? Is it bad? Well, no, it's almost like a natural phenomenon.
Right.
Is dragons. Because if I recall correctly, dragons are also associated with weather patterns.
Yes, that's right.
So that's a big influence, especially in Southeast Asian cultures, as well as that a dragon, you know, brings a storm or brings a weather. It's a natural occurrence. Whether that natural occurrence is a disaster or healing or cleansing is another like view of dragons.
Right. Right. Whereas in the West, I mean, you think of, I talked about the story of St. George slaying the dragon. Well, the reason he did is because the dragon, in order to appease this dragon, the villagers in this, and it was always these small villages that dragons seemed to be terrorizing. They weren't like landing on London.
Mm-hmm.
They just seemed to be. And so he was eating all the sheep. And then when they ran out of sheep, they had to start throwing people out there. So then they thought, okay. But then again, it has the romantic notion, too, because it's the fair maiden. She's the next supposed victim of the dragon. Here comes St. George to slay the dragon, and you have the story.
Yeah. That's always interesting. And again, it would be a knight in shining armor or a knight, someone anointed in some way, often bearing the shield of a cross or something like that. to face the dragon, kind of get into the idea that it's the Lord's chosen or something. They've been chosen for that task.
Right.
They're going to have to go on a journey. Now, I guess where in literature have we seen dragons kind of pop up? Because they're not, dragons aren't real, unfortunately.
Right.
I wish.
Or maybe fortunately.
Maybe fortunately. You know, we don't know what's in the ocean technically.
That's true.
So I guess where else do these influences lie, at least from what you've found or read through historical texts? Like where from Beowulf on have dragons really shown themselves?
I think Beowulf, we got sort of the fire breather, and I think that influenced the rest of the literature.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a story, Geoffrey of Monmouth wrote in the 13th century. He wrote a book called the, and I'll say it in Latin because it sounds better, and I can sound smart, Historia Regnum Britanniae. So it's the history of the kings of Britain. Of course, it's not really a history because he has a story about a Romano-Celtic overlord named Vortigern, who's trying to build a tower in Wales. He's trying to protect himself against the Saxons, and it keeps falling down. And so his magicians, he described them as magicians. I'm sure it was like soothsayers or something. They told him, well, if you take the book, you have to find a child who's fatherless. I don't know why fatherless, but we'll just go with it. And kill this child and sprinkle the blood on this land and it won't keep falling down.
Classic.
Yes. So, of course, they go looking for a child who's fatherless, and they find one. He just happens to be a prophet named Merlin. And so Merlin is brought, and he says to these, well, as what Geoffrey of Monmouth called them, magicians, he said, you guys are lying. He said, I'll tell you why your thing keeps falling down, because there's a lake under there. And if you drain the lake, you'll find two dragons. And so Vortigern, yes, this isn't real history, so... Vortigern, he drained the lake, and he awoke the two dragons. One was red, one was white, and they started fighting. And what historians have kind of thought was, and it was Merlin who predicted the white would defeat the red, and that was sort of a symbolic of the Saxons beating the Britons. But then Merlin also added, at some point, the red dragon will come back, and that was the British beating the Saxons. So it was kind of used there, I think, as a, not quite sure of the word.
Like a metaphor?
Like a metaphor. There you go. Sorry. Sorry, folks. And so, yes, I think it was kind of used there as a metaphor. Maybe that wasn't Geoffrey's intent.
I say like a metaphor, using a simile to make a metaphor. But
yeah, that's what I just did. Too.
English majors, we got words.
So I think that's what it was. But that's the first time really Merlin pops up in the... And of course, you know, the dragon to me, it's interesting because the word comes from Old French and then into Old English. And then we have Beowulf. But then we have these other English stories of dragons. We have Germanic stories of dragons. And we have Nordic. The Poetic Edda has a story of dragons in it.
Indeed, yes.
But we don't really have like Italian dragons or Spanish. I mean, I'm sure maybe there are.
Or even, I was actually thinking about this a few minutes ago, even like an American dragon. That's not really a thing.
So it almost seems to me that the cultures that came up with a lot of these dragon stories were the ones, they were the last ones probably to be Romanized, if they were ever Romanized at all. The Scandinavians never were. Most of Germany wasn't, or what we would consider, a Tacitus called it Hermania. That's what we'd consider that. And England, or even the British Isles, the Ireland, Wales, and Scotland. And so it's almost like they were the last ones to be that, and they were probably one of the last ones to be Christianized as well. So that I think, I wonder if there's, I don't know if there's anything here, but when I was looking at this, I kept thinking, these were the dragon stories are, and it's almost like they held on to that mythology a little longer. And then, of course, when you get to the Bible, when it has stories of dragons in it, it's almost like all these different things are coming to meet on a Western dragon.
And it's about slaying the dragons, almost like it's slaying that old culture or idea, almost.
Right, or slaying evil. You know, because the a lot of people thought of the fire breathing as hellfire. And so, I don't know, it was just something I thought of when I was looking at this going, it's these different cultures are the ones that sort of have a heavy duty.
It really is, because you think, I'm trying to think, I think Nordic, I think English. I'm not as familiar with Germanic in terms of Western cultures with dragons. I don't think of Egyptian either for dragons.
Well, that's
either.
True. Well, they were more serpents. They were more, I think they were more of the ancient, like Greece and Rome.
Yeah. So I guess we're really almost Northern European-esque.
Yes.
Is where dragons more lie, which could be more mountainous. I'm not sure of the mountains of Europe at all. So correct me if I'm wrong.
That's where this Vortigern guy was building his tower on a mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And Mount something in Wales, and I can't remember.
Oh, and again, when we think about mountains and the echoing of sound, you know, if a boulder falls in a mountain and echoes,
right,
it could sound like, you know, a dragon's roar or something like that. Again, with I said this in the beginning of, you know, that rumors, different sounds going through, what could possibly make those massive sounds? Well, of course, there are dragons fighting under the mountain. Right. Something like that could be.
Of course. I mean, you're looking for, they don't really have the language we have today to describe things. So they may look at it as, and so it is interesting. And if you saw a reptile you were never familiar with, you might think, you know, what is this thing? Some kind of monster? Or a fossil. I mean, if you would find a full fossil of a dinosaur, let's say intact, somehow you found it.
Mm-hmm.
And you had no way to describe that. Well, of course, you'd probably give it a supernatural explanation.
Yeah. Even that would make sense if, depending on the wings, because wings, you know, they're not going to be preserved in over time, but you'll see the bones.
Yep.
And if you find a footprint and they're huge, what else could it be?
I mean, we have stories of giants, you know, from ancient times. Now we're giants, just people who happen to be abnormally taller than everybody else, but they had no real way to, I don't think they were really giant or cyclopses roaming the earth. I just think that there was something they didn't understand, so they explained it as best they could.
And it's interesting, all of these proliferate through different types of literature. There's, you were talking about, this was the book that started with Merlin, what was that called again? The History of the Kings of Britain. That's a fairly well-respected piece of literature. Beowulf, another piece of literature that has gone through to proliferate these. Travel writings, another form of literature, has another quality to it. Consistency is those exaggerations. Dragons are going to show up. So it's almost like, it's weird that they're written observations rather than you'd think, you know, an old wives' tale of some sort, like a fairy tale. But these aren't fairy tales. These are things that were written as trying to say they were quote unquote fact or experiences that people have had.
Well, even in the legend of King Arthur, and I know there's, is he real? Was he not? What? So I'll just say legend for now. Legend of King Arthur, I mean, his father, Pendragon, I mean, it's right in the name.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Welsh. That's a good Welsh name, Pendragon. And so even in the King Arthur myth, the dragons are there. And of course, Merlin's there too.
So. Yeah, tell us more about what you've seen in the King Arthur mythology with dragons. How did they kind of, we know the red and the white here, but how?
That was, Geoffrey. I don't know, I know that... they were in there. I didn't see too much of the King Arthur stuff. I'm sure, I know I'm familiar with Pendragon. I'm familiar with Merlin being in there.
Yeah, let's talk Pendragon and Merlin. How were dragons used in those legends or tales? But I guess when you say Pendragon, it's kind of in the name. So let's skip over from Arthur to more modern, more, because we've kind of gone through, and Tolkien is about, you know, I say Tolkien's modern, but I mean modern culturally, I guess. So how have, I guess from Tolkien on, we've seen dragons take a huge name in fantasy, for especially fantasy.
Like Ursula Le Guin.
Mm-hmm.
I think I said that right. A lot of her works have dragons in them.
And also video games. Yes. Dragons have taken a whole new meaning once you've gotten video games. Because now it's not just, you know, written down. We actually get visuals.
Right.
We don't just have descriptions. We're getting, you know, Smaug in full CGI, big dragon.
Right, and the interesting thing about Smaug is, again, tracing back to Beowulf, he's awakened because someone steals something from his hoard, and mm-hmm. that's what happened in Beowulf. A slave stole a cup. I mean, so the dragon's laying on this huge stack of treasure, but he'll notice if you take one little thing from it. And then he punishes everybody by destroying everything.
Yeah.
But then you see Harry Potter. I mean, and of course, some of her dragons were Ukrainian. Ukrainian Iron Belly, I think, was one of them that was guarding the Gringotts Bank.
Yeah, and that's coming, those dragons that were in Goblet of Fire coming from all over the place.
Yes, they're coming from all over the world,
mm-hmm.
which is funny because they're winged. And then we were just talking about how there's a difference. But I don't think Hollywood is very, you know, going to go, hey, that's a winged dragon, that's not. I don't think that's going to happen. But yeah, so you really see it, and it's an icon almost that you don't, that I don't know if it'll ever leave us. It's almost more popular today than ever, you know, put dragons on things. In fact, the dragon became the symbol of alchemists.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wait, that's, I say mm-hmm like I know, that's new to me. Right. Go on with that.
Well, the alchemists, the symbol for mercury was a dragon. I'm not sure why but then it evolved into the actual symbol for alchemy. And I believe it was, I don't know if it was to denote strength or whatever, but it did become that.
Okay. Alchemy, that's interesting. I'm going to be like stuck on alchemy for a while because that's new. I'm actually going to have to look more stuff up about alchemy and dragons because, I mean, alchemy throughout is, I mean, it's not scientific, but right. It's something that's proliferated similar to dragons.
Right, and the thing about alchemy is it actually did lead to science. I mean, to chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it did.
And, well, we think of, I don't know, how much do you know about alligators in general? Or crocodilians?
Not really much, but it's funny because when you look at Asian dragons with their legs,
mm-hmm.
they do look like they're crocodile legs. You know, well, the legs with the...
Part of the reason I bring this up, if you ever heard a crocodilian bellow, it sounds like a dragon growl, or it sounds like this ancient guttural sound that shakes the water. They're mating or matching their territory is what right. it really is.
Right.
But it's coming from it's impossible for me to try to make this sound. So if you're listening to this, look up like an alligator bellow.
Right. Well, it's like a roar, I would imagine.
Not a roar. It's not a roar. It can sound sort of. I'm gonna have to show you, or after we're shooting this show, what this sounds like because it is
right.
very unique and it is very ancient. And if you are someone who has no idea where this is coming from, terrifying.
Well, in fact, it's funny you say that because that's one of the things Marco Polo mentioned about the Chinese crocodile. So I did look up Chinese crocodile.
Ooh, okay.
The species. And sure enough, they're very vocal.
Yes.
And so I thought, now you can match what he's saying with the reality is they're very vocal. They vocalize back and forth to each other and stuff. Yeah. So
and if you don't know what's there, it sounds like something that will eat you, essentially.
Yes.
So... I mean, there's clear tie-ins to reality when we have dragons. And, you know, something about dragons, and this is what I'm going to say has no historical value. Something about dragons is almost like forever mystical to us.
Yeah.
Something incredible in
right.
multiple ways. Because not only do we have the idea of dragons are evil now, but we have the idea of riding dragons. Or dragon, like
right.
think Aragorn in literature,
yes.
or How to Train Your Dragon, those films and books. the idea of also riding them and having them as pets or having them as allies is also through getting kind of this idea in Western culture now as well.
That's interesting because that's very Eastern view of dragons. They were seen as powerful rulers would have dragons as companions. They would, you know, they could ride dragons. Because even though the dragons in the East didn't have wings, they could still fly.
Mm-hmm. Or you'd be blessed by the dragons, something like that.
In fact, there was a time where only the emperor of China could have the emblem of the dragon on his clothes or his furniture, anything that he had. No one else could because that symbolized his power.
It's almost like the color yellow, almost, because I'm thinking the color yellow is a royal color. And
it's funny you say that because the dragon, what they call the dragon that replaced the winged dragon in Chinese art and that, was a yellow dragon. So it's funny that we have these concepts of almost Eastern concepts of a dragon. Now in Western film and literature, like you talk about Aragorn and that. So,
I mean, this is all kind of the global blending of culture. It's kind of been going on. And of course, for writers, and I'm, you know, a fantasy writer as well.
I didn't know
that. We kind of pull things from all over and put them together and make it our own thing. This is another idea of that, that dragons can be all of these things at once. Both friendly and devilish, which are also very human
very
characteristics.
Human. Yes, yes.
Oh gosh, we really could talk about this for a long time.
But the only fantasy I ever wrote was my resume.
And then you've been here ever since.
Exactly.
Well, Scott, you have tickled my brain with this topic, but what are we going to be cruising through next time?
Well, ironically, staying sort of on this same road, I'm going to talk about alchemy.
All right. So we go from dragons to alchemy.
And how it sort of gave birth to our science of chemistry.
Well, for everyone listening, your homework is to watch Full Metal Alchemist. We'll talk about that next time, though, as we go forward.
Oh, hey, Scott, did you know that listeners can actually contact us now?
They can. How can they do that?
Yeah, they can just email us at historycruise@mykpl.info.
Great. Also, like and subscribe on any of the platforms you find this podcast.